One evening, her water broke. There wasn't time to get help. He delivered the child and lay him in a manger.
Not your normal Super Bowl commercial. We'll tell you about the unusual way God's message is being spread during this weekend's big game. Catholics in the world's youngest country, gleeful about their visit from Pope Francis. Highlights of his trip to South Sudan ahead. International aid floods into the region as the death toll mounts in Turkey and Syria after a devastating earthquake. We're joined by the head of the emergency response team for Caritas Internationalis.
My hope for the couples is that they grow stronger in the skills of marriage, communicating especially, grow stronger in their faith, in their love for each other.
And it's National Marriage Week, a look at the sacrament of marriage through a Catholic Encounter program. It's date night at the Basilica. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
This is the first time, to our knowledge, that a message about Jesus will be visible in the Super Bowl.
Are you ready for some football? Are you ready for some Jesus? Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. It's Super Bowl weekend, so we couldn't resist kicking off the program with sports as we all get ready for the big game between the Philadelphia Eagles and Kansas City Chiefs. And yes, there is a religious angle to Super Bowl 57. And as is often the case with the Super Bowl, it's all about the commercials. Reporter Mark Irons has our story.
When the Super Bowl kicks off, the most watched broadcast in America is expected to receive more than 100 million viewers. Their attention not only on the game, but the commercials. Companies spend millions of dollars for seconds of airtime to advertise their products. Viewers fed messages about chips and beer, and this year,
it was his cross to bear.
A message about Jesus will be visible in the Super Bowl. It is going to be surprising.
Brad Hill is a spokesperson for He Gets Us. The nonprofit has produced a multifaceted media campaign.
To our knowledge, this is the biggest faith-related campaign in history.
Hill says it seeks to reintroduce the culture to the radical love of Jesus. Two fresh ads will be released nationally during the Super Bowl, but the campaign isn't new.
A rebel took to the streets. He recruited others to join him.
Videos circulating since last year, including this one showing 87 million views on YouTube.
But they weren't part of a gang spreading hate and terror. They were spreading love.
We fully believe that Jesus was fully man and also fully God. The ad messages really focused primarily on the humanity of Jesus, who he was, how he lived, what he taught.
The hope, to draw people a step closer to Jesus to learn more about him. Hill says the campaign is not funded by a particular church or denomination, but backing from evangelical Christian groups has been reported. The family of David Green, the evangelical founder of Hobby Lobby, is reportedly behind the project, along with other anonymous donors, raising millions of dollars. And He Gets Us plans to spend millions more in the years to come to publicly promote Jesus. The campaign represents just one example of faith-based marketing.
We are the Catholic Church.
Call it advertising or evangelizing. For the Catholic Church, Tom Peterson says it's been very effective.
We're not selling anything. We're inviting people into a relationship with Jesus.
Peterson, a former advertising executive, founded Catholics Come Home in 1998. The nonprofit has been running ads on major TV networks across the country for years.
If you're looking for something more, check out CatholicsComeHome.com.
Peterson says the data collected shows an impact.
And hundreds of thousands of souls return to the Catholic Church.
Relying on grassroots fundraising and coordination with Catholic dioceses to provide an invitation.
We say you're coming home to a church Jesus started that feeds you with the Eucharist, his body, blood, soul, and divinity, forgives you in the sacrament of reconciliation, guides the church family with the Holy Spirit to the end of time.
Peterson has a series on EWTN profiling people who've returned to the faith. Catholics Come Home and He Gets Us may be different in their approach to faith-based marketing. Different costs, benefits, and target audience. But both operations are trying to fill a need.
If you look at the human condition in the world, right, there is a fundamental need for love.
Cabrini-Pack is a marketing professor at the Catholic University of America. Part of her mission is to form students and future marketers in a Catholic vision.
I'm actually training change agents in my classrooms because we're talking about how do we work towards a common good.
And that means a whole lot more than maximizing profit. Pack mentioned some other faith-based entrepreneurial ventures that could positively impact the broader public, like Father Mike Schmidt's Bible in a Year podcast and the Chosen series.
They're providing an offering, but they're not doing it with the usual tactics. So tactics include commercials, ads.
Whatever the tactics may be, the goal seems to be reaching people right where they are.
With, you know, significant resourcing, what we find is like, in our society, people are turning to their screens.
Social media as well, because that's what people are consuming, and they're the ones we need to invite home.
The church exists to evangelize.
Archbishop Charles Thompson of Indianapolis is the chairman-elect of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Evangelization and Catechesis. He says the goal of the church is to lead people to Jesus.
And make sure we stand focused on him and leading people to that encounter with Christ. But we can never grow weary of doing that.
The Archbishop believes ad campaigns, evangelization through media, and social media messaging can only be effective if genuine person-to-person encounters follow. If the people who learn about Christ through marketing efforts can authentically meet him through the love of others. Over the years, he's asked converts to Catholicism what's led them to the faith.
They always say my spouse, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, a co-worker, a classmate, a friend. They tell me it's someone, it's a person.
Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
Evangelization efforts aren't just on the airwaves. They're also taking place right on the ground, 30 minutes away from the Super Bowl stadium in downtown Phoenix. The Diocese of Phoenix started a grassroots campaign to welcome football fans who are flocking to the Super Bowl Experience Center, which hosts exhibits, games, merchandise, and more. It's located at the Convention Center right across the street from St. Mary's Basilica. Joyce Coronel, the program manager for Christ in Our Neighborhood, is leading the efforts to welcome visiting fans. Thank you so much for joining us. What inspired you to start this campaign?
Oh my gosh, very inspired by, of course, what happened to Damar Hamlin, seeing the whole country praying for him, praying for this, you know, all the football fans and ESPN, sportscasters, everyone praying. And so we discussed it amongst ourselves here at the Pastoral Center, the communications team. We thought, why not have a big banner welcoming football fans on the front of the Basilica? So 30-foot banner, right? But then from there, we thought, let's do more. Let's offer sacramentals. Let's offer information. Let's evangelize. Let's put a confessional on the street. So that's what we've done. We actually have a confessional there, a big wooden screen with a grill and a kneeler. And we've got big signs everywhere saying, you know, priest available for confession or just want to talk. And we've got priests covering every hour that we're out there, 12 hours on Saturday and a little fewer hours on Thursday and Friday. But it's been just amazing to see lay people and priests come together to bring that hope and that love of Jesus Christ to Super Bowl fans.
That's beautiful. And I know that this really is a moment of prayer. People are realizing post-COVID that maybe they're interested in the spiritual, maybe they've fallen away from the spiritual habits that we know are so enriching. How are you going to bring those fans in, aside from the big banner? You've got all these volunteers, you're offering the sacraments, you're offering these great opportunities right across the street. How do you plan to bring them in?
Well, you know, it's been really interesting to watch. I was out there all day yesterday. We've got our big table. It's surrounded. It's got a huge banner on it that says Roman Catholic Diocese of Phoenix. And then we're holding up crosses. We've got a big processional cross set up there. So it's eye-catching. And as people walk past, we're holding up crosses. We're holding up miraculous medals. And we're saying, hey, we'd love to give you a free cross. Would you like a free miraculous medal? And then these are not just trinkets. We're giving them a pamphlet to go with it that explains, you know, who Jesus is and why we need him as Savior in our life. We're giving them the explanation of how we got the miraculous medal. We're giving out rosaries. So
beautiful.
People see us. And, you know, if we lock eyes with them, we have a big sign that says, can we pray for you? And it's amazing to see people come up and ask for prayers. You know, people on the outside might look like everything's fine, but on the inside, they're longing for Jesus. We all are. and he's longing for us. So I think sometimes we lock eyes with them and they start to say, no, no, thanks. But then they come back. And we've seen that happen a few times where people walk past, but then they come back and they do want to talk to us.
That's beautiful. Are you finding anything surprising in those conversations? You're offering the sacraments. You're giving people the opportunity to reconnect with the rosary through prayer. So it's here's something to teach you how to pray, but also come pray with us. What are you learning about these fans and their needs?
Well, you know, the needs are amazing. And I try to share with them, and our volunteers will share from the heart, like, and I just tell them, my life before I had completely surrendered to the Lord Jesus, I was a mess. I needed his peace. And now I have it in my heart. And I found the freedom that we all long for and the joy that he wants to give us. And so I just speak from the heart about that with them. And people open up. We had a woman that stopped by last night. She was a mother of six. She lost three of her children.
Oh.
And she was heartbroken. And she said, we told God three strikes, you're out. And she wasn't interested. But then she came back and our volunteers prayed with her. And she explained that her three surviving children were away from God, were away from the church. So we have a list. We're keeping a list of prayer intentions and we're going to keep praying for those people. We're going to pray for every single person that we prayed with, every person who made contact with us. But we're also praying for the people that just walked by and maybe didn't approach us. But that seed was planted because they saw a priest standing there with a stole ready to offer them God's mercy. They saw people ready to give them a free gift. We're giving water bottles too.
That's
important.
We're giving
out granola bars. We're meeting people where they are and just going out to find them, because you're right. People, since COVID, a lot of folks haven't come back and a lot of people have just drifted away. So we got to go out to where they are. And Super Bowl fans, we want to reach them too. We want to reach everybody with the good news that Jesus is the answer to every problem. And his hope is an eternal hope that we all have access to.
That's exactly right. He never said he'd solve our problems, but he said that he would accompany us and work with us until that eternal grace that we all long for. So then what are your hopes? You said it's not a one and done. It's not a walk by. I'm just going to pray with you here in this moment. What is your hope? And does this campaign live on?
The campaign lives on, absolutely. Everywhere we go, I keep sacramentals with me, and I'm always talking to people. I think it's a great opportunity when we're out and about to shine that light of Christ, that hope and that love that we found, and share it with other people in gentle ways. And so, the mission lives on. We want to do events like this again. I'm very grateful to St. Paul Street Evangelization. I went to their conference last summer and learned how to do this. Brought it back here. There were already teams here in our diocese doing it. So we joined their efforts, and we do hope that every person that we spoke with will think about the Lord and will think about really giving their heart entirely to him and surrendering their heart and having that that wonderful peace that we have when we know Jesus.
Absolutely.
That's what we want for every single person. The ones that didn't stop by, same thing. We're hoping that we planted that seed and that they'll think about God and they'll realize they have a place in their heart that can never be filled until it knows him.
That's exactly right. Well, we hope that the impact is even greater than you ever imagined, and we'll be praying for your efforts. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The competition this Super Bowl weekend is not confined to just the football field. Catholic leaders in Philadelphia and Kansas City have something to say about the big game, too. We don't report rumors here, but we understand there might just be a bet involved. That's ahead. Plus, we turn to serious matters, important global events, when EWTN News in Depth returns.
Pope Francis wraps up his trip to Africa, where the crowds greeted him with massive enthusiasm. We'll put the pontiff's years of global travel in perspective. Insight from the Wall Street Journal's Vatican correspondent. We talked to a major international relief agency working around the clock to help victims of one of the worst earthquakes in decades as rescue and recovery teams search through mountains of rubble in cities across Turkey and Syria.
It's so important to take the time to go out on a date and to work on your marriage.
And later, faith as the key to a successful marriage. We'll tell you about a special program that's reinvigorating relationships and bringing couples closer to God. We'll be right back.
time when he passed through, my tears was flowing because seeing a Pope always in a picture, but today seeing him with my own eyes, I was shed down, my tears was flowing.
Catholics in the world's youngest country, South Sudan, celebrate their first papal visit. Hopeful, the Holy Father's words will inspire peace in a country struggling with violence. Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth. Last Sunday in Africa, Pope Francis wrapped up his first papal trip of the year. On this program last week, we brought you coverage of the Holy Father's trip to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Now, a look at the second leg of his trip to South Sudan on what he called a pilgrimage of peace.
We need peace for our children. We need peace for our children. Peace in South Sudan.
South Sudan gained independence in 2011. Despite its wealth of oil, it's one of the least developed countries in the world. Just 2 years after gaining independence, South Sudan fell into a bloody civil war. More than 400,000 people died due to the war, and an estimated 4 million are displaced. Though the war officially ended a couple of years ago, real progress remains slow, and violence remains common.
The country is still bleeding, and we hope that the coming of the Holy Father will help us to really build peace in this country.
Father Don Bosco Anyala, editor-in-chief for ACI Africa, explained that Pope Francis had his heart set on visiting the young, war-torn nation for years.
Pope Francis seems to have a very special love for Africa, but again, a very particular, intense love for the people of God in South Sudan.
He mentioned a trip to South Sudan as early as 2017. And in 2019, he personally asked South Sudanese rivals visiting the Vatican to find a way to end the conflict.
He made a dramatic gesture of bending down, going on his knees, and kissing the feet of the president, Salva Kiir, and the main opposition leader, who is now the first vice president, Dr. Riek Machar. This gesture has been repeated over and over again as a symbol of the humility and the longing for lasting peace that Pope Francis has for the people of God in South Sudan.
To make this longing for peace a reality, the Holy Father marked another apostolic first, an ecumenical trip with Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby and moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, Ian Greenshields. In a symbolic gesture of the unity of South Sudan's churches, the three Christian leaders joined together for an interdenominational prayer service and asked South Sudanese leaders to unite for their people.
Our Christian brothers and the world Christian leaders still do remember us, and they've come to be with us, which is a great encouragement to us all.
During his visit, Pope Francis also made a special effort to highlight women and young girls in a country with some of the highest rates of sexual and gender-based violence in the world.
In the ongoing conflict, women seem to bear the brunt. They are the ones that are left to widows when their husbands have gone to the battlefields. They are the ones left struggling with their children when there is conflict or running from their homes, being displaced.
Pope Francis met with displaced women who shared their heartbreaking stories. Pope Francis blessed and thanked the South Sudanese women and told the country that its future depends on its women.
Mothers, women are the key to transforming the country. If they receive the proper opportunities through their industriousness and their natural gift of protecting life, they will have the ability to change the face of South Sudan, to give it a peaceful and cohesive development.
On his last day in South Sudan, Pope Francis celebrated Sunday Mass with more than 100,000 people attending. South Sudanese celebrated their first papal Mass with immense joy.
Look at the crowd everywhere. People are so happy, so enjoyable. Wow, it's wonderful, it's amazing.
Now that Pope Francis has returned home to the Vatican, it's up to the leaders and people of South Sudan to end the bloodshed once and for all.
The visit of the Holy Father, alongside the other two leaders, by itself will not bring peace. It will require that the political class, the people of South Sudan themselves, desire the peace.
The Pope's trip to Africa is but one of 40 overseas journeys the Holy Father has taken so far during the 10 years of his papacy, with stops in 59 countries. Many of his trips historic in their ecumenical outreach. What's the Pope's strategy in his travel choices? What does it say about his pontificate? Who better to ask than our next guest, Francis Rocca. Frank has been covering the Vatican for nearly two decades, the last 8 years as the Vatican correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Frank, it's so great to have you here with us. Despite his age and mobility problems, Pope Francis has packed in a tremendous amount of travel in just 10 years. What's the overall strategy regarding which countries are selected for these papal visits?
Well, he said this week as he was flying back from South Sudan, speaking to the reporters on the plane, he said, the criterion is I choose to visit the smallest countries. People will say, but he went to France. No, I went to Strasbourg. I will go to Marseille, not to France. The little ones, the little ones. He said the criterion is to get to know a little bit about the hidden Europe. He's talking about Europe in this case. That part of Europe that has so much culture but is not known, to accompany countries, for example, Albania. My choice is not to try to fall into the globalization of indifference. Mm. And I think that applies more broadly to the whole world. You know, he's chosen to go to often to countries that don't have large Catholic populations, you know, countries that small, very poor countries, and to skip some of the more obvious countries. He still has not been to Spain, which right. is remarkable given Spain's importance in the Catholic Church and the fact that he's from Latin America and the fact that he's a Jesuit, which is an order founded by a Spanish saint. So he hasn't been to Spain and he hasn't been to Germany, but he has been to Albania, as he says, and he has been to Bosnia and he has been to, and he's talking about going to Mongolia.
Right, and in visiting these countries, he's also appointing leaders who are in these minority Catholic countries. So it's an interesting thing to watch as well. You were on his historic visit to Iraq in 2021 when he met with the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. Tell us about his outreach to the Muslim world.
Well, that's right. That's been a major theme of his papacy, of his pontificate. Absolutely. He's made a great friendship with the head of the rector of Al-Azhar University in Cairo. And as you mentioned, he met with a Shiite leader there in Iraq. That's been a big emphasis of his. That trip was also noteworthy because, of course, it's hard to remember now, but hardly anybody was traveling. This mm-hmm. was early 2021, and people were afraid of COVID. And, of course, there was fear of violence there when we went on that trip. And all the security people said, this is a high-risk trip, but he went anyway.
Absolutely. And so he's not afraid of high-risk trips, and he's not afraid to ask for mercy and to seek forgiveness. It's a big theme of his reconciliation. And he did last year in Canada when he was meeting with the indigenous population there. What does a visit like that tell us about his papacy?
Well, that was a remarkable trip because it was very, for anybody who's been on these things, on these papal trips, you know, there's usually a sort of a joyous aspect, celebratory aspect, but this was very somber. He was there to apologize, and he did so over and over again. And certainly, obviously, members of the church were happy to see him, but the reception, even on local media, everyone was, it was an overall mood of skepticism, a real somber mood. I think the spectacle of the Pope in his wheelchair going there and saying he was sorry for the abuses of the indigenous peoples over the centuries, also in some cases with the participation of the Catholic Church, I think that did have an impact, but it wasn't the usual joyous papal trip that you get, especially in Christian countries.
That's right, an image of great humility, but also with the dwindling Catholic population there, there's a reason that you might assume Canada would be a priority for him. Another place that is a priority, even though some like to say that he's at odds with this country, is the United States. He's visited the U.S. once, speaking to a joint session of Congress in 2015, and he has many friends, but also many vocal critics in the U.S. Do you think he'll come again? And do you think that he has some objectives in pastoring and being pastoral to the U.S. community?
Well, I doubt that he will come to the United States again. But then with this Pope, you never want to say never because he'll always surprise you. I think one thing that was interesting about that trip is he'd agreed to come for the World Meeting of Families. And then at the very close to the last minute, he tacked on Cuba. Mm-hmm. Cuba is actually the first stop. So it became a trip to Cuba and the United States. And he'd been instrumental, of course, in brokering an agreement between Cuba and the United States to improve their relations. But one couldn't help thinking that he was trying to remind the United States, too, you know, you're not alone even in your hemisphere. And, you know, you're part of a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm, definitely trying to do that. And the Pope, and when you speak about Cuba, he's had different strategies in dealing with communism in Cuba and in China, as well as with the war in Ukraine. How would you characterize this papacy's outreach and approach to dictatorships?
Well, with Cuba, I mean, there was predictably some dissatisfaction and criticism when he didn't meet with dissidents there in Cuba and he didn't criticize the regime more publicly for its treatment of dissidents. But you have to put it in perspective. I was there with Benedict in 2012, and there was the same criticism made at the same then. And I believe that happened when John Paul visited too in the late 90s. So the Vatican strategy has been with Cuba, and the bishop's strategy there has been not perhaps as aggressive as some people would like to defend the human rights issues there, and as Cuban dissidents would like. So with regard to China, of course, that's even more controversial. The Vatican has made a deal on the appointment of bishops, which basically shares that responsibility with the Chinese government, and some people say that hasn't worked out. There haven't been really hardly any bishops named under this new approach, under this new deal, just a few, and so some feel that perhaps it was a mistake. But the Pope's view clearly is that it's a long game, and he thinks this is going to be worthwhile in the end.
That's right, even though he has expressed some frustration in his dealings with China. Well, Frank, thank you so much for being with us and for clarifying this great legacy that I know we're going to be celebrating his decade as Pope in a couple of weeks. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's much more ahead on EWTN News In Depth. Turkey and Syria assess earthquake damage as thousands are believed dead and thousands more are left homeless in freezing winter temperatures. President Biden shares his priorities for the nation in the State of the Union address and the latest on those imprisoned Catholic clergy in Nicaragua. Top headlines are next in the Week in Review.
Preghiamo insieme perché...
Let's pray together so that our brothers and sisters can go on as they face this tragedy. And we ask the Virgin Mary to protect them.
In his weekly general audience, Pope Francis calls for prayers for earthquake victims in Turkey and Syria. This, as the staggering death toll from Monday's massive earthquake and aftershocks continues to rise. News about the magnitude 7.8 quake tops the Week in Review. The numbers keep rising every day, but at the time that we record this program, more than 21,000 people have died, more than 70,000 others injured in one of the region's worst earthquakes in decades. The disaster has become an overwhelming humanitarian crisis. As days go by, the chances of pulling any more survivors out of the rubble dwindles. With thousands of buildings collapsed throughout both Turkey and Syria, many tens of thousands of people are homeless in the bitter winter cold. The massive quake struck in the middle of the night on Monday as people were sleeping. Many people were trapped and killed as buildings pancaked. Aid workers say no one in the quake zone has escaped tragedy. If residents themselves survived, they have lost loved ones. Turkish President Erdogan has appealed to the world for humanitarian aid. The destruction stretched hundreds of miles across southeastern Turkey and into northwest Syria. Many Turkish residents have criticized the Turkish government for its response to the crisis, saying rescuers were slow to arrive. Erdogan has acknowledged shortcomings in the rescue response. And while there has been attention to the cities, many fear the death toll will continue to spiral upwards as search teams reach outlying rural areas. While international relief is ramping up and efforts to get aid to Turkey, getting help to hard-hit areas like this in Syria is complicated because of the long-running civil war there. Millions of war refugees live in the quake zone. They're already dependent on humanitarian aid. Because of the civil war, there's only one border crossing open between Turkey and northwest Syria in the conflict zone, and it was damaged during the earthquake. It wasn't until Thursday that the first UN relief convoy was able to get into the region. Caritas Internacionalis is one of many relief agencies responding to this disaster. It's a confederation of Catholic relief, development, and social service organizations. John Coughlin is the team leader for the emergency response team. He joins us now. John, thank you so much for joining us. What do the efforts of Caritas look like on the ground in Turkey and Syria? Do you have boots on the ground in these countries?
Thanks, Monse. Yes, we do. Again, we have national Caritas in both countries, and they're doing their best to meet the needs in this absolutely catastrophic crisis. Again, it's not only one earthquake, it's two earthquakes. And, you know, we're dealing with, you know, deaths that are going over 21,000 people already. And I think, you know, what we're getting from the teams is that, you know, this is only a small snapshot of what's happening. So I think we're going to be facing a really difficult situation and a really long-term response.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, the situations are very different and the numbers are devastating. The situations in Syria and Turkey, they do differ. Two earthquakes, but two very different in-country situations. For instance, the death toll, severity, and the damage or the relief efforts must be different because of that. What can you tell us?
So, yes, definitely the you know, the two earthquakes hit in Turkey. So, you know, this is where the major damage has been. The human toll is absolutely much greater than it was in Syria. So also we need to be thinking that Turkey has been hosting over 4 million refugees in addition to its own population. So, you know, there are, you know, its own citizens, but also people that are vulnerable from the places that they've had to flee because of war, because of other, you know, conditions that they were forced to flee.
And how does that make your relief efforts different?
Well, again, if you're working in a country where there is conflict, such as Syria, then, you know, we need to be very careful about what we do. And, you know, make sure that we're assessing the needs that are there. And, you know, I think the main thing is that we're making sure that we're reaching out to the right people. Again, even in Syria, we're talking about 6 million people who have been displaced because of conflict. So you not only have a critical situation because of the economy, because of conflict in Syria, but also this natural disaster that's happened on top of these crises.
What did your efforts in Syria look like before the crisis?
So Syria, we've been working since the beginning the beginning of the crisis in 2012. We have a number of strong teams on the ground in different countries, in different places, such as one of the most affected areas hit by the earthquake, which is Aleppo. In Aleppo, there will be distributions today of mattresses and warm things to keep people sheltered, at least to some extent, because again, this is it's in winter, it's freezing. And, you know, in some places there is snow. So, you know, wow. People are on the streets and, you know, where there is tent, whether they have been given tents, there are tents, or they're just, you know, sleeping in the open. So it really is a dramatic situation. And, you know, survival is really a difficult thing.
Right. They're cold, they're hungry. But Caritas says that it also serves the whole person. What's the spiritual dimension here? How do you serve people spiritually?
I think the question is, you know, looking at the whole person, you know, that it's not only providing, goods, you know, it's not only providing food, it's not only providing, let's say, household items or blankets. It's, again, you know, dealing with this person as a human being, dealing with this person not as somebody that's receiving that, but somebody with feelings, somebody that with a life that, you know, really needs the attention of others, you know, to feel the warmth of others, to feel people's reaching out to them. Again, I think this thing this idea that Pope Francis has put out of, you know, reaching out to the peripheries and, you know, really seeing the human face is part of what makes Caritas different to other aid organizations.
And John, how does this affect your team internally? I'm sure that being on the ground takes its toll on your team as well.
Yes, you know, particularly in Turkey, who the office of Caritas was destroyed. The cathedral was destroyed in the Diocese of Anatolia. So it's not only, you know, what has happened to your neighbors, what has happened to your relatives, what has happened to the people that you serve, but also, you know, you've lost your house, you've lost your office. So, you know, we've finally reached the diocese, and, you know, we're looking at, okay, well, how do we set up an office? You know, what are the buildings that we can use as warehouses where we can put in relief items?
The challenges, again, it's really, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
That come with staging your relief efforts. Well, we will be praying for you, and I know that all of our viewers thank you in advance for everything that you do and will continue to do to help everyone in Syria and in Turkey. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Monse. Thanks very much.
If you're looking for a way to help the earthquake victims and are interested in this Caritas mission, you can find out more at caritas.org. The U.S. Agency for International Development activated locally based disaster assistance teams in the hours following the earthquake. President Joe Biden spoke with President Erdogan on Monday, expressing his condolences and pledging his support to aid to the NATO ally. Wednesday, two search and rescue teams arrived from the U.S., consisting of structural engineers, doctors, and technical search specialists. Some 160 personnel and a dozen rescue dogs are helping in rescue efforts. 170,000 pounds of humanitarian equipment, including generators, medical supplies, concrete breakers, and water purification systems, were also flown to Turkey. The disaster in Turkey and Syria was not mentioned during President Biden's State of the Union on Tuesday. Biden focused primarily on domestic policy, including infrastructure, the economy, and health care. He pressed Republicans multiple times to work with him to finish the job of rebuilding the economy and uniting the nation. In his address, meant to reassure a country fraught with pessimism and political divisions, he drew a raucous response from Republicans when he alleged some in the GOP want to end Social Security and Medicare.
Instead of making the wealthy pay their fair share, some Republicans want Medicare and Social Security to sunset. I'm not saying it's a majority. Let me give you, anybody who doubts it, contact my office. I'll give you a copy of the proposal.
The president briefly mentioned codifying abortion federally and also discussed the need to end police violence in the wake of the death of Tyree Nichols, who died 3 days after being beaten by five Memphis police officers. Nichols's mother and stepfather were in the visitors gallery during the address. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky gave a speech to the British Parliament this week to request more aid in a surprise visit on Wednesday. It was his second foreign trip since the war broke out a year ago. He made a direct plea for more heavy weaponry, including fighter jets. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak implied that there would be no guarantee on jets because of the years of training it takes to learn how to fly the sophisticated aircrafts. His government is, however, accelerating the delivery of other military equipment to Ukraine. Zelensky then quickly flew to Paris to meet with French and German leaders before heading to Brussels. That's where he was greeted by a standing ovation in the Parliament of the European Union. Zelensky made a heartfelt appeal to allow the Ukraine to join the EU, noting his nation upholds similar values. While thanking the countries who have supported Ukraine through the war, he continued his plea for more military aid to defeat Russia. An update now on the Catholic clergy and laity in Nicaragua who were found guilty of conspiring to undermine national security. We've learned after they were sentenced to 10 years in prison this week, they were then released on Thursday to the United States. They were part of a group of more than 220 political prisoners that arrived at Dulles Airport in Virginia. Family and friends of those prisoners welcomed them with cheers and waving flags. The Biden administration helped facilitate their release from the government of President Daniel Ortega, which is widely condemned as a dictatorship. It's not clear what Nicaragua will get in exchange, if anything at all. Bishop Rolando Alvarez also faces charges of conspiracy to undermine national security in Nicaragua. He still awaits his sentencing and remains under house arrest. This video from last August shows the bishop walking with a monstrance on the street to which he is confined. The Bishops' Conference of the European Union this week demanded Bishop Alvarez's release. And now, time to get a little more upbeat here on EWTN News in Depth as we commemorate National Marriage Week.
Fun in marriage is serious business. We've never met a couple who are on the way to the divorce court who are having fun together.
We talk to Catholic couples joyous about their marriage encounter and their date nights at the Basilica. Next.
We're just days away from St. Valentine's Day. And that day commemorating love coincides with National Marriage Week and World Marriage Day on Sunday. What a great time to take a look at the sacrament of marriage and the Catholic Church's desire to build a culture of life and love between husband and wife. Roselle Regis talked to couples deepening their marriage commitment through Christ in this Catholic Life report.
Define love.
To will the good of another.
Our number one rule was to lead each other to heaven. And that's the best good I can think of.
In the Catholic Church, marriage is much more than a lifelong commitment of faithful love.
Marriage is a covenant between a man and a woman who give themselves to each other and to God.
Father Edward Hathaway has served as the rector of the Basilica of St. Mary in Alexandria, Virginia since 2015. One of his goals has been to create a program to strengthen marriages in his parish.
As a pastor, it's of great interest for me and responsibility for me to help those marriages be strong and vibrant, joyful places where children are raised and receive catechesis in the faith.
This comes at a time when sacramental marriages have declined 70% in the U.S. alone since 1969, even as the number of Catholics in the country has grown significantly. Just last year, Pope Francis called for a lengthier and more effective catechesis in preparation for marriage. The Holy Father said, "The Church must walk closely with couples toward marriage, as many couples," he noted, "only receive superficial preparation before their wedding." Titled Catechumenal Pathways for Married Life, the 97-page document is designed to help young people understand the sacrament, prepare engaged couples for marriage, and support newlyweds in the first years of their married life. Father Hathaway explains that holy marriage takes a lot of sacrifice, patience, self-reflection, and humility.
With any vocation, you need to work at it. It doesn't just happen, great marriage. If you can pray out loud together, maybe kneeling together before you go to bed at night, praying the family rosary. These are ways in which we acknowledge the supernatural and open our hearts to grace.
Last year in the fall, the Basilica of St. Mary introduced Date Night at the Basilica. The apostolate utilizes a program called 10 Great Dates, which helps spark intimacy, romance, and fruitful conversations between married and engaged couples as they spend time together on a date.
Any state has a theme. Starts with building a priority marriage, making your marriage a priority, learning to talk, managing your problems, your issues, conflict.
Anger management, conflict.
Encouraging one another.
Other great date topics include balancing your role as partner and parent, having an intentional marriage, and deepening your intimacy. The book and video course was developed by David and Claudia Arp. For decades, the duo has been offering resources and training to help couples build better marriages and families.
Date Night at the Basilica starts off with a social gathering
followed by a discussion about one of the 10 great dates topics. Then the married couples are off to go on their dates.
We thought it would be a good opportunity to carve some time out for ourselves as a married couple, but then to also meet other couples in the parish and kind of get encouraged by them and share experiences as a married couple.
Raymond and Rebecca Moore have been married for 8 years now. By participating in date night at the Basilica and meeting other married couples, they say their marriage has brought them closer to their faith.
Pray for your spouse and pray with your spouse. That's kind of drawing back to the strength of God and asking Him for help for your spouse and for yourself.
It enriches our lives, but we've gotten to meet a lot of wonderful people along the way as well.
One of the other couples participating, Leah and Chase Hatton, also believe faith is what binds them together.
I'd say faith is crucial. So apart from our COVID wedding, my wife suffered with 3 miscarriages that were really hard. And our faith really was able to help us navigate that grief in a healthy way.
9 months ago, Leah and Chase welcomed baby Annie. As new parents, date night at the Basilica is just what they needed to re-energize their marriage.
After having Annie, it was so nice that they offered childcare, and just, it's so hard, especially we're not from here and our family isn't here. They've really helped us through this period of a lot of change, be able to pour into our marriage and our family now too, because they do so many great things.
Anne Somerset, one of the coordinators for date night at the Basilica, enjoys witnessing couples rekindle their love for one another at each session.
It's also so great to watch the couples on their way out the door to their dates. You know, kind of the twinkle in the eye, the feeling of anticipation of a great night, and just also feeling that feeling of being happy and in love, I think, that we all have when we first start dating, comes back, and you get to see that, and that's just wonderful. And I hope that they'll know that they have a community that supports them in their church, in their parish, and all the other Catholic married couples they know.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Last week, before National Marriage Week and World Marriage Day, Pope Francis reiterated the strong need to rediscover the meaning and value of the union between a man and a woman. And last year, the Vatican released a set of guidelines for local churches to help better prepare future spouses for marriage. These new guidelines call for a lengthier process than has been in place, and it comes in 3 parts. First is the preparation, which lasts about a year and begins with a rite of engagement. The second phase includes a few months of more immediate preparation and a pre-wedding retreat. Lastly, the third phase consists of assisting newlyweds during their first 2 or 3 years of marriage. If you want to learn more about the marriage preparation programs available to you locally, contact your diocesan office. And for more information about the 10 Great Dates program that Rozelle told us about in her report, visit 10greatdates.org. Up next, we have 2 church leaders in the wings, ready to talk a little football. It's Philly versus Kansas City when we return. As we mentioned at the top of this program, the Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles face off Sunday evening at the Super Bowl. And there's some spiritual heavyweights supporting each team. Archbishop Nelson Perez of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia and Bishop James Johnson of the Diocese of Kansas City, St. Joseph, Missouri, are each rooting for their teams to take home that Super Bowl trophy. Thank you both for being with us. I'm sure you're looking forward to this weekend's kickoff. Archbishop Perez, let me start with you. Are you a big football fan? You look dressed for the occasion.
Well, you know, everybody in Philly is a football fan this week, right?
Absolutely.
And of course, of these big, big games. Absolutely. I was actually at the playoff game with the Giants, in which we kind of creamed them within the first 10 minutes. So I just want to put that out there.
That's very good. Bishop Johnston, how are you feeling?
We're feeling very confident, too. We're kind of living through the golden age of Kansas City Chiefs football out here in Kansas City, and they're going to their 3rd Super Bowl in 4 years, so we're hoping to bring another one back and hoping we can stand up to that that good Philadelphia defense.
Oh, boy. Well, it sounds like you're not only dressed for the occasion, but your hearts are ready to pray for the occasion. Are you each hearing something special for your parishioners? Bishop Johnson, any chance you're getting a few tips on keeping your homily short so people can get to the game?
Well, yeah. Fortunately, I've got early masses on Sunday, so but I'm still going to keep it short. We're going to probably add some extra petitions to the prayers of the faithful, though, for the Chiefs.
Archbishop Nelson, are there any recommendations you'll be making about fostering unity among families so that we don't all fight with each other this Sunday?
Well, absolutely. You know, people are passionate about their sports teams, and that's a wonderful thing, right? Because it celebrates life, and it celebrates achievement, and it celebrates teamwork, right? That these teams work as a team, and that's why both of them have gotten to the Super Bowl. So our families have to also work as a team, because a team that doesn't work that way doesn't win.
That's exactly right. Prayer is essential. What is it that they say? The family that prays together stays together. Definitely probably the same for a team, right?
Right?
Bishop Johnson, a little bit of catechism here. Tell us, is it okay to pray for our team to win and for another team to lose?
Well, I would say with regard to the first question, yes, it's okay to pray for your own team to play to their best of their ability so that they can be victorious. I've never advised people to pray for bad things to happen to other people. So we just pray, focus on our own team, and they're excelling to the best of their abilities.
And a little bit of grace and mercy for those who don't win. Archbishop Nelson, I have it on a good account that you came here with a wager in mind. Can you tell me what's going on?
So I'm going to place a wager to Bishop Johnston of $500 to go to our Catholic charities or Catholic social services to serve those in need. So get your checkbook out, Bishop.
All right, well, game on. I think I'll take you up on that wager, Archbishop Perez. That sounds like a good thing. And although I was looking forward to a bunch of Philly cheesesteaks, but that sounds probably better. It'll help more people.
I'll put one in the mail for you. I don't know how it's going to get there, but...
Well, it definitely sounds like you've got some charitable wagers in mind to make sure that we keep our eye on the prize, which is definitely heaven rather than divisions within teams. Is there one last tip that you have? When we think about sports, we think about everything that comes with that, the family unity, the food that we share with each other, the bread that we break. Any tips on keeping your eye on the prize this Sunday? Bishop Johnson.
Well, you know, our lives are made up of so many things, and every community has sports teams, and even from high school on up, and we see our faith reflected, and it can be woven into so many aspects of our lives, including sports and athletics. And so we should celebrate the opportunity that we have to have such great fun together through this competition.
Thank you. Archbishop Nelson, last word with you.
Well, you know, it's a great time for both Kansas City and Philadelphia, especially as Philadelphia wins the Super Bowl. but it is a time of people stepping away from sometimes difficult lives and challenging lives and rallying around sport and community and family and teamwork. And there's a part of our Christianity that a Christian faith that is about all those things, right? And especially as we run the real race.
That's right.
The real race of grace and faith as we all really go for the bigger Super Bowl of them all, and that is to get to heaven.
That's right. The final race, which we know has already been won. Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
You,
and go Chiefs.
Great. Go Eagles. And God bless you, Bishop Johnson. It's wonderful to hear you and see you.
Thanks, Archbishop. You too. God bless.
God bless.
So for all you football fans, strap in. The bet is on to see which Catholic Charities organization gets that nice donation. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again, same time next week, for more news and information important to your Catholic life. See you then.